everyone. This is Holland.
And this is Kristen.
We're both women, we're both preachers, and we're both scholars. And so we created the Preach Her Stories podcast to celebrate women preachers.
On this podcast, we interview amazing women preachers from today and highlight groundbreaking women preachers from the past.
Everyone is welcome here, and we encourage all of our listeners to consider how a richer understanding of women preachers' experiences benefits us all.
So grab some tea, curl up in a snuggly blanket, and join the conversation.
Hi, Holland.
Hi, Kristen. Welcome to this episode of our Preacher Stories podcast.
Our first interview episode.
Very first interview episode. We have a very exciting interview coming to you today. Mm-hmm. Today's interview is with Reverend Dr. Joanne Lyon.
And this is just so thrilling that we could have her as our first interview because, as you all will observe, we are big fans of Dr. Joanne Lyon for good reason. She really has forged the path for women clergy, especially in the Wesleyan holiness tradition. She's been doing this work for a long time and has been consistent every step of the way. I'll just introduce you to her. Dr. Joanne Lyon started World Hope International in the early 90s, a global, how would you describe it?
A global nonprofit relief organization.
That's right. Relief and, development. Yeah, relief and development organization, still going strong under the leadership of her son now, I think.
Yes.
She was the first woman general superintendent of the Wesleyan Church. She is now the general superintendent emerita of the Wesleyan Church. She has, during her tenure and beyond that, been on President Obama's Faith Advisory Council. She does a lot of work in D.C., primarily in her role as the vice chair of the National Association of Evangelicals. So Joanne is known far and wide beyond our denomination, and she's really gained a lot of respect ecumenically and is just such a treasure for the Wesleyan Church. And we were thrilled to be able to talk to her today about being a woman clergy.
Yes. Kristen and I should probably apologize in advance because we are big fangirls of Joanne Lyon, as you'll probably hear during the interview. She's been very influential in both of our lives and our development, and particularly for me, as I was coming up as a young clergywoman, I had the great honor of actually being ordained by Joanne, which is a very special moment in my own history. Mm-hmm. And so today's conversation with Joanne is really focused on calling. Mm-hmm. And what does calling look like for us, for Joanne in particular, for us as women clergy, and how do we talk about calling both as women and as a church? So we hope you enjoy this interview.
So we're going to start off with a warm-up question, Joanne, that we're hoping to ask all of our interviewees. And it's, what's something that's bringing you joy right now in this season of your life?
Well, what's bringing me joy are my grandchildren, of course, and my children, both. But we have 10 grandchildren, and I just saw 5 of them yesterday in DC. And I loved it when the oldest one in that pack, who's in the 5th grade, said, that group calls me Mima, said, Mima, I want to tell you, I am reading a chapter in Genesis every day, and I'm writing down my favorite verse and then a prayer. And she said, I'm doing it on a piece of paper, but I saw on Amazon a journal, and that's what I'd like for Christmas. And it's got it all organized, and I can copy everything from my paper. So I came home last night and ordered the journal right now. She's not going to wait till Christmas. Yeah. I mean, the whole journal was $7.99, you know. So.
Just to transition a bit, because in our conversation today, Kristen and I have been really exploring this question of calling and what does calling mean and look like? And what does it mean specifically for us as women sometimes mm-hmm. in the church and still continuing to wrestle through that? Mm-hmm. And so we just want to ask you, how do you define calling?
That is a great question, Holland. And I was just invited to be with another denomination who is doing this whole thing with cohorts of pastors on the call. I think we've all kind of limited what the call is. Mm-hmm. We've limited it to that particular thing in that particular day. And we all have to, I think we've been forced to have the same story. But God is creative, and God calls all of us in different ways that fit who we are. And so one of the exercises that I had those pastors do, and I do it a lot, what did you want to be when you were a little kid? What did you want to be when you grew up? And when you put aside all the stuff that says you can't be what you said you want to be when you grew up, or what are the elements of what you want to be when you grew up? If you go back to that, you'll find there's a part of your call in that as a child, when it's pure, just pure. There's no obstruction. There are no limits. So I think many times if we even do that exercise personally, we will find that that's where some of the, so an example in my life, well, I had one is a really funny one because I grew up part of my life in Oklahoma. And so, and out in Western Oklahoma, you know, lots of cowboys and cowgirls and rodeos and all that. So I tell you, I just worked and worked and worked, tried to learn how to rope and all of that. I was going to be a cowgirl when I grew up, you know. And I remember this bothered my father and mother, both ordained ministers. Our daughter is not going to be a cowgirl, you know. So I remember I'm sure that's what was going on in their mind. I remember one time my father said to me, well, you know, real cowgirls aren't from Oklahoma. They're either from Texas or Montana. Well, I knew I'd never live in Texas or Montana, so gave up that little dream right there. But when I think about all the elements that go in to be a cowgirl, I mean, you had to practice, you had to, you know, all of this kind of thing. But a greater one was when I was 6 years old, we lived in Enid, Oklahoma. This is during segregation. And I only saw people of color one day a week. And that it was early on a Wednesday morning when the African-American woman came to pick up our trash. And I never saw people of color any other time. And she was always singing early in the morning. And I can remember her singing as she did her work. And I was so intrigued. And finally, I think I bugged my dad so much that he said, okay. I said, where does she live? You know, et cetera. Finally, one day he said, I'll take you out there where she lives. And he didn't know her person where she lived, but in those days we had what was called Colored Town. And I'll never forget that, the day that the paved road ended and dirt roads began right in my own town.
Wow.
And I saw a totally different life. I saw houses that were barely livable, all kinds of things. And I immediately said to my dad, why don't they come to our church? Because if you're the preacher's kid, everything centers around your church. And he said, oh, no, they have their own church. And I was in first grade. And I said, why don't they come to my school? Oh, they have their own school. And that's all he said. But somehow that was enough that made me know something is not right with this. I'm not getting the right answers someplace. Mm-hmm. And I think that was where God began to put that call of justice in my heart at that very early age. I did not know how that was going to live out. But I do know that every time we would go through large cities, I would want to go through the poor section of the city, even though the highway didn't take us. And I must say, many times my dad would oblige me for that. So I think he sensed there was some kind of call there. I don't know that he could verbalize it, but you know, something. So I think that begins that call of where you are in your life and where it is. Now, I grew and then began to add you know, obviously scripture and church history and all of that. But then as far as the call to preach is concerned, I will now in our tradition, the Wesleyan Church, we ordained first woman to be ordained in the United States was ordained by the founder of the Wesleyan Church, Wesleyan Methodist Church. And so being ordained as a woman was never a question. However, after World War II, it became not popular. And if you do the study, you'll see that the number of women to be ordained goes straight down. Yes. Well, my mother was ordained. I can remember when my mother was rather discarded in her ordination. I mean, it was, and then at the church was becoming more and more institutionalized. So when a group becomes institutionalized, then males take over the institution, the power structure. And so when I sensed God calling me to preach, I don't want to do that because I love my mother, but I see some of the criticism she's receiving now. I don't want to do that. I don't think I resisted God. I didn't follow it exactly, but God just kept opening doors, and I kept walking through them. And many of them were combined with the justice issues and leadership. And I think I really believe in the whole piece of fullness of time, where God is shaping you for what he has you to do. I mean, the fullness of time when Jesus came, I don't think God sat up in heaven and said, on such and such a day, I'm saying, you know, it was when all these pieces came together, and it was fullness of time. And so I think in the fullness of time, I moved along and began to integrate many of these pieces together. And then ultimately, there was just like a thumb in my back, you have got to get ordained. And so I was doing doctoral work in historical theology at St. Louis University. And so much of what I was doing combined with this. And so so that's then finally, and I was doing a lot of speaking. I mean, in those days, you spoke at women's, at mother-daughter banquets and things like that. And then I would speak, I would preach in church. I was not ordained, but I would preach in church and I would preach in some of these places. But then I just knew, you've got to get ordained. And so that's something of the journey. Well, as I look back now, I'm really old, so I have a long way to look back. But I see all along, God was shaping me for what I didn't know he was shaping me for. And the leadership I learned working almost a decade in the urban context of Kansas City, Missouri, from some of the greatest African-American leaders that I know, shaped by that leadership, shaped by various places, all of this, I see then God was in the process of shaping for everything. It wasn't just for, I mean, I think it shaped me for leadership at that place. But then that leadership piece then obviously impacted later things that I did. And so it just moved in those kinds of directions.
It's mm-hmm. amazing.
I mean, as you were just talking about, you've had quite a journey in life and ministry. Can you walk us through kind of some of those significant points from recognizing as a child, like your calling to justice issues and, mm-hmm. and, you know, eventually that led you through all these different stages to ordination. Can you walk us through mm-hmm. some of those stages of key moments in your journey in ministry?
Well, so I went to college and graduated, from the University of Cincinnati. So, you know, you got to think about women in those days, we could be either teachers or nurses, you know, mm-hmm. or social workers or something like that. And so I chose to be a teacher. And the reason I chose to be a teacher was because I wanted to teach in the inner city. Mm-hmm. So it was that kind of call that was still happening with that. And so I taught school and then I went ahead to get a master's degree in counseling psychology, because I thought that's part of how this moves, working in justice issues. This is where this is. And so then as I worked then you've got to know, then the real crux came with the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And where are we in the church? Well, now it's sad to say, but the Wesleyan Church that led the way in abolition hid during the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. We'd already conformed to greater institutions, other church institutions and groups. And we were told that all of this was about communism. And so therefore we could not be a part of this. How in the world we split that in our theology and we split that, I don't know. But I must say, I'll leap ahead hugely here, but Dr. Virgil Mitchell, right before he passed away, who was the general superintendent at the time of merger in 1968 of the Wesleyan Church and the Pilgrim Holiness Church. And he said, as I look back at that, he said, 1968, we had major things happening in our culture. You know, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Civil rights movement took on all of these kinds. I mean, civil rights movement was even prior, but it peaked during mm-hmm. those days. Mm-hmm. And he said, and we have not one thing in our general conference minutes to reference anything going on in the culture.
Wow.
And we did not do anything. And some of his words before he died said, may it never happen again.
Wow.
And I can't get away from I respected him hugely. And I can't get away from that.
Yeah.
But somehow during those days, we lived in Kansas City, Missouri on that side. And it was the streets were on fire, all kinds of things. And I became involved and I became invited to some grants that came in from the federal government. I became invited to work in that context and ended up working there for almost a decade. And part of that, again, was my call, mm-hmm. Was the call of justice and the call of my own faith. And then that's when I became really more acquainted with the history. So I was highly influenced by the writings of Ron Sider and Donald Dayton and those folks. Wow, that's who we are. Why are we mm-hmm. not here?
Yeah. You know?
So I was not silent about that in our church in those days either. Mm-hmm. And talked about it and talked about our history and talked about what we were doing and all of this. So that would have been that part. And then I had four children later. I mean, 10 years, no kids, then 5.5 years, 4 kids. So that takes it when women are talking about their journey, you know, you generally are doing men generally, their career is kind of like straight up or whatever. It goes kind of like this. Women's is going and being kind of there and then takes up again. That's why the studies show that women's careers last a lot longer than men's because we kind of have these breaks in the process and then we take off again. And so during some of that time, I still did speaking and I still did some writing, but I didn't punch the clock every day, but still got opened a few doors along the way and a variety of things. I did, then Asbury Seminary asked me to teach as an adjunct on church and society. So I did that. I just commuted from we lived in Grand Rapids, Michigan then, and drove down twice a semester. That was before online, of course. So you had to do it either face-to-face or not. Well, we decided to set up that I would do two class. You needed 30 hours of face-to-face. So I would do two face-to-face a semester. So I do it Friday night, 3 hours. I can't remember how many hours on Saturday and on Monday, and did that twice a semester. It was a really wonderful time and did a variety of issues regarding church and society in those classes. So that was another piece that a whole nother group of people, and it began to invest in this and then moved on. And of course, we always pastored. So I was part of the pastoral staff in that and worked in various ways in pastoring. So that was the journey. And then I started World Hope in 1996. And it was actually during, I started at St. Louis University then, and it was during that time that the thumb was in my back. And I was ordained right about the same time I started World Hope also. And I, as I look back, I realize that, and I was already doing quite a bit. And even while I was teaching that class in church and society, I've got to get ordained. I'm telling everybody down here to get ordained, and I'm not ordained myself. So it was much of that that piece. But it's interesting. I had no idea what God meant globally, because the first time I went to Pakistan, that was the very first the first year we started. Because we were coming alongside the Wesleyan Church in Pakistan. And the leader of Pakistan said, you really can't come unless your husband comes. And Wayne never wanted to do that. Because one of the things he said to me when we first started, he said, now, I'm not going to go with you. Because what will happen is people will start asking me the questions because I'm the male about what to do. And I don't know a thing about it. And I don't want to look like a fool. And he said, you're the one who knows it all. So we're just not going to get into all of this. And besides, you know, he was pastoring a church. He couldn't run around. So, and at that point, I had really given up in the local church to do this global piece. So he went the first time. And then I said, and when I got there, it occurred to me, I didn't mention to him that I was ordained. Oh, well, if you're ordained, he doesn't have to come along. I went back 4 times to Pakistan because it didn't matter. So that, as I looked at that, India, the same. I was in India. Mm. They said, she's going to help me baptize today. First woman ordained we've had here.
Wow.
That's when I thought, that's what God was talking about.
That's why.
You know.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah.
Isn't that? Amazing. So globally, I mean, it's been, and as I've moved about in the Muslim world and all these kinds of things, ordination means something.
That's amazing. I would not have anticipated that.
So I think women have really got to look at that. They'll say, oh, I can do what I can do without being ordained. I get that. But you know what? God could open up a lot more doors if you were.
Right. Yeah. So interesting. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, Joanne, like that's an example, I think, of a wonderful example of one of the successes in your journey. But where have you felt challenges arise on this journey of ministry and preaching?
Oh, well, many, for sure. And I think actually, I was elected as a general superintendent of the Wesleyan Church, first female to lead the denomination, although we ordained the first woman, but it took 150 years to determine if women could really have power. So I think there were several things in that. I think we get narrow down in our denomination. And I must say that I had some wonderful leaders. I'm not going to rag on anything because it was really wonderful to work with every leader that I worked with. But sometimes people can get really narrow and say, well, she really can't do this because she's never done my job. Mm. You know, she's never been a district superintendent, or she's never headed up this thing in the headquarters. Well, I had some other people who came alongside and supported me and said, look, we didn't hire somebody who's done our job. We hired somebody, I don't mean hired, we elected someone who's a leader. We needed somebody who could lead us, not whether they had been able to do that job or not. And I think that's where we get kind of, we narrow the gap. Instead of bringing in leaders who have had a multitude of experiences outside to add more to that position, mm-hmm. rather than
Do you think, is that, would those same critiques have been leveled at a male general superintendent?
A good question. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That is a good question. Yeah, it is a good question, Kristen. I really couldn't answer that. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you've got to remember, that I was old when I was elected to this. So age helps. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to remember that age and experience help, because they could not deny the experiences I'd had at various levels in the world, for that matter.
Right.
So I don't want to discourage women and say you can't do anything until you're, 65 years old. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do that, but try to get as many experiences as you can along the way. But that did help. As far as I'm concerned, it did help.
Mm-hmm. Like, as Joanne, as you know, Kristen and I are both rhetorical scholars, in addition mm-hmm. to being, women of faith and preachers ourselves, right? As rhetorical scholars, we're both big fans of Jackie Jones Royster and Gisa Kirsch, who are two kind of landmark names in feminist rhetorical studies. Mm-hmm. One of the practices that they have forwarded and advanced in our field is this concept of strategic contemplation. And among other things, as Royster and Kirsch explain, strategic contemplation means recognizing what was made possible for us as feminist rhetorical scholars through other women's work, how their efforts have enabled us to stand where we are today, and how their visions make it possible for us to imagine a future worth working for. And, for me, as a clergywoman and a rhetorical scholar who studies women preachers, this practice of strategic contemplation and honoring the women who've made my very existence possible mm-hmm. is so important. And I'm curious to hear for you at this stage in your life and your ministry, who might you point to as the women who paved the way for you to be the woman preacher, leader, extraordinaire that you are? And how do you see yourself as continuing that legacy?
That's a great question, because I have to go back to history. Mm-hmm. And Rosemary Radford Ruther wrote a great book called Women of Spirit a long time ago. In fact, my book is falling apart and I just keep it. I probably need to get a new one, but it's all marked up. And she starts with the early church and the women in the early church. And she's a wonderful scholar, so she does a beautiful job with it, and comes on through the Middle Ages. And then she has a whole section on women in the holiness movement in that piece. And then she goes on. So when I first read that, it gave me permission, I guess, to say. And then as I began to really look at the history in our own movement, Mel Dieter, who was a provost at Asbury back in the day, did a lot of study regarding women and in the holiness movement and did all kinds of things. Then Don and Lucille Sider-Dayton did a paper in 1974. A long time ago, on women in the holiness movement. It's still in mimeograph form. I still have a copy of it in mimeograph paper. Nobody listening to this podcast even knows what that is. Yeah. But I'll never forget when I read that. I just burst into tears many times, just as I read the power. And okay, so this is these are women totally in my tradition.
Wow.
And how they, what they did and how they were, Phoebe Palmer and Catherine Booth and Mary Willing and many of these people. But what I liked also were some of the strong statements of some of the men. So Seth C. Reese, who was the founder, one of the founders of the Pilgrim Holiness Church, which is an antecedent of the Wesleyan Church, he had this statement. I don't know if he said, it's nothing but bigotry, pride, selfishness, and a desire for bossing in men that have kept women from their rightful place.
Wow.
Speaking the truth. And so I double dared a young woman the other day who was going out to speak about women in ministry. So I said, I double dog dare you to open up your speech with this. She wouldn't take you there.
I know.
Wow.
And so it was those kinds of things. And then W.B. Godbee, who was an old holiness scholar, he had a whole book called Women Preachers. And in it, he says, oh, what a victory Satan won when he paralyzed 2/3 of the army. I mean, wow. Those are strong statements in those days. Yeah. And they lived it out. They didn't just say, I mean, Seth Reese's wife, his name was Huldah. She was a preacher too, you know? And so I look at that history. And so I think that shaped me more, gave me courage, I think,
in
moving forward. Wait a minute, I'm only living what, and then the scriptures, of course, you went back in the early church, even to the New Testament, of course, gone back to that, we've all done that. But I think probably some of those gave me courage to move forward.
And how do you see them extend? How do you see yourself extending that legacy with your own ministry and work?
Well, I have a lot of young women who call me, we talk, and I just keep encouraging them, no, move forward, move forward, move forward. And there's nothing that can hold you back. And I think the problem that we have, and I had it too, is you've got local churches that are, the way our structure is, you can't appoint a female to take a church. Mm-hmm. They have to elect.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so this is where the rubber meets the road. You ask what were some of my disappointments was that when we could, and I must say, I worked with district superintendents who were really trying hard, but it's hard to turn a church board in some of it. So those are our major pieces that we're struggling with. Mm-hmm. Then I become concerned. Then women finally give up the local church and go off and start a nonprofit.
That's right.
Yeah.
And we've got to have women in the local church.
That's right.
And I mean, I understand that. Finally, if you're not accepted there, where will you be? Now, when I was the general superintendent, I had three different districts that opened up, and I had three different districts that asked me, is there a female that we could have as a district superintendent? Mm-hmm. And at that time, because we lost an entire generation that people just went elsewhere because there was nothing, we didn't have any women that could step up to that at that point. Mm-hmm. We do now.
So our last question here then for you is, Joanne, who is your favorite woman preacher or just a woman preacher that you think our audience needs to know about?
Well, of wonderful woman preachers, Fleming Rutledge. And when she pastored Grace Episcopal in New York City, I used to listen to her all the time. My sister attended that church during those days. And so she would send me the sermons. And she is, and still her tweets are, I mean, every tweet she puts out, I like.
Awesome. Wonderful.
So I think she's an excellent preacher. Another woman that's a great preacher is Carla Sundberg. Mm-hmm. Carla is a general superintendent of the Nazarene Church, and Carla is a great preacher, and she brings with her all of her church history. And so it makes it come alive and makes the scriptures come alive. And I love her daily things as she writes of what she's just learning in her daily devotions.
Well, wow. There was so much there.
Wow. Yes. So much there. So much richness from years of ministry and incredible leadership.
Wow. Yes. So much to talk about. And in fact, we have had to cut out 2/3 of the interview just to keep it to one episode and focus specifically on calling, because there's so much even to debrief Holland in just her personal story.
Yes.
Of calling,
so much.
Ministry. Where do we begin?
Well, let's start with near the beginning of our conversation when Joanne was talking about how we, especially as women, we limit our calling. Mm-hmm. And I think we see this throughout the church, but I would say I see it significantly with women too, how we limit our calling
because we've been kind of forced to all have the same story. Mm-hmm. What do you think? How did that moment hit you, Kristen?
Well, yeah, I think it resonated with me because I think it traditionally we think of calling in one aspect. And for men, I think it is pretty straightforward. And not to limit men's sense of calling either, but I think mm-hmm. there's a pre-established pattern or steps or, you know, to take to become, you know, to be called into ministry and then be ordained. But because those pre-existing steps have not always been encouraged for women, I think we see that mm-hmm. highlighted in Joanne's story. We have to take sort of a different pathway into calling. Yes. And she redeems that for us. She says that is nothing is wasted, right? Like God can use all of our life experience, and our calling can come in lots of different ways. We can sort of ease into that calling in lots of different ways. And then for her specifically, what I was so struck with was, you know, she, in her mind, she could either be a teacher or a nurse.
Yes.
Those were the two options for her. And so she chose teaching. And but God wasn't deterred by that, right? She could start in teaching. He could use those years of teaching in the inner city, that experience with racial reconciliation, as she said, learning from Black leaders to all shape and form the ministry that God was building for her to have eventually. I just found that really moving.
Yes, yes. And I was also struck by how Joanne described this kind of sense of calling that had been building throughout her life from childhood, as you mentioned, through all those different experiences, and then feeling this sense of calling that was almost like something that couldn't be identified mm-hmm. until she started to really excavate church history.
Right.
Right. And really to dig into the history of the church and learn about this legacy of specifically women mm-hmm. in the church that had gone before her, that helped her to see the way forward for herself or new possibilities for herself. I know that's been, you know, part of my own story as well, is digging into the history of the church and women and recognizing that I'm not alone right. in this, that there have been many women that have gone before me. And so this narrative that surrounded me of growing up of, you know, women aren't leaders in the church, that's just simply not the case.
Well, and there's two points here that I think are so important. First, I know for our tradition, the Wesleyan Holiness tradition, one of the major gifts Joanne Lyon has given us is to retell the story over and over again. She has yes. re-given us back our history. Now, there are others that have gone before her. She mentions Ron Sider and Donald Dayton. Those are both Wesleyan Holiness scholars who in the 90s were writing about women in our tradition. But the reason why that needed to be excavated was, and this she practiced for us in the interview, what she has done her entire career, which was retell the history. You could just see her lay it out that it started with our founders, Orange Scott and Luther Lee. They were abolitionists, and it was a real short step then to become, to then turn and say, well, if Black people shouldn't be kept from ministry and serving God, then neither should women. And so the Wesleyan Church was the first to ordain, she mentions the first ordained women, which was Antoinette Brown, which we're going to talk a little bit more about that here in a minute with our silhouetted figure tribute. But that it's, and then she talked about how there was a rise of women pre the war in ministry, and then post the war, we really became shaped by culture. We became shaped by other faith traditions that downplayed women mm-hmm. in ministry, and we lost touch with that heritage. So one of the great gifts Dr. Lyon has given us is she keeps telling that story. She keeps referencing the scholars. She keeps yes. bringing that story to the forefront for us and reminding us this is who we are, so we don't lose sight of that.
Yes. Yes. And as you mentioned, one of the segments that we will be featuring on this podcast is what we're calling our silhouetted figure tribute. And this name comes from two rhetorical scholars, Jackie Jones Royster and Gisa Kirsch, who in their work on feminist rhetorical scholarship have called for greater attention and new research methods to be developed to help us look for these figures that have been silhouetted throughout history and in society that have been overlooked for a variety of reasons. Many of them are women. And as we look at the church and we look specifically at church history, we see that indeed the silhouetted figures that speak specifically to us are often women. Mm-hmm. And so today I want to pay tribute and highlight Reverend Mary Will, who was the very first woman to be ordained into the Wesleyan Church, the denomination that Joanne comes from, that Kristen and I have a background in as well. And Reverend Mary A. Will was ordained in 1861 in Illinois. So the founder of the Wesleyan Church, Reverend Luther Lee, performed the first woman's ordination of Antoinette Brown about a decade earlier. But Antoinette Brown actually was not ordained specifically into this tradition, right? Mm-hmm. Mary Will was the first one to be ordained in 1861. And she was then the first woman fully ordained into what would become the Wesleyan Church. What's really fascinating about Mary Will is that her ordination was revoked a couple of years after that. She was ordained in 1861. Yes, I see your look of surprise there,
Kristen. I did not know that. Yes. I didn't know any of this. This is all, I love this. I'm going to love this part of our podcast because I'm going to learn from you. I love it. Go ahead.
As I've dug into all this research and trying to, you know, recover and reclaim all these women preachers, I'm astounded by their stories and what they've gone through. And Mary Will was ordained in 1861, and then her ordination was revoked in 1864, so just 3 years later. Mm-hmm. And from what I've been able to piece together from all of the archival evidence that survives Mary Will, is she was ordained by her local conference in Illinois. And they recognized her gifts. She pastored a church, built the church building, which those of you who are pastoring and know anything about a building campaign recognize that this is no small undertaking, right? Pastored the church. And then in 1864, when the matter went before the General Church Conference, the General Church Conference declared that the Illinois Conference's actions in ordaining a woman were unscriptural.
Wow.
And so Mary Will's ordination was revoked. However, in 1875, the General Church Conference revisited this decision again and declared that her deposition was irregular and illegal. And those are the words in the General Church minutes, that it was irregular and illegal. So we have this fascinating, fascinating figure, this woman who was ordained, deposed, and then reinstated into ministry. And what I love about Mary Will's story, well, I love many things about Mary Will, but what I love about her story is how it really resonates with me as kind of reflective of our experiences as women in the church, as we celebrate these victories, but then also those victories don't last long. Sometimes we'll then encounter backlash, we'll encounter some challenges and things along the way. And while I'm, you know, grieved for, I'm sure all of the emotions and the hurt that Mary Will experienced in that moment, I take perhaps a strange sense of comfort in recognizing mm-hmm. that I'm not the first woman to walk this path and right. to experience difficulty. And so anyone else listening who's had a difficult road or continues to walk a difficult road, we stand with you. Mm-hmm. We stand with you, and you are not alone. And I encourage you to continue to seek out your place on this road, in this legacy of women that that we stand in, that Joanne stands in, and that many, many clergy women and women preachers throughout history stand in.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's such a good reminder that the trajectory of redemption, of women being brought into the church as leaders, is not going to be a straight line moving up all the time. And we probably would do ourselves a favor to sort of take a step back and look at the big picture and take a deep breath and realize that there's going to be fluctuations and that there will be setbacks, there will be victories, there'll be more setbacks. But overall, through prayer and faith and work, it is moving. We are getting more and more and more redeemed. The church is becoming yes. more and more redeemed. And I think that's the hope that I hear every time I talk to Joanne Lyon. She is open and honest about the obstacles and the struggles. And yet those never see, I don't even think it's a conscious choice on her part not to focus on it. I think she genuinely doesn't see the role of women in the church as overall discouraging. I think for her, yes. it is always moving in the direction of hope and, you could just hear that in the interview when she says things like women have longer careers than men. Like, yes, we do have hiccups where we're, you know, maybe we're stopping to have to take care of our families. But on the whole, we do get back in there. We do have careers. We do come back around. When she talked about ordination, you know, as you would say, I'm using your language here because I'm learning from you, ordination as a sponsor of women, right? And in clergy women, that is a choice that you can make that will give you a platform. When you are ordained, it legitimately gives you a platform. And then when she talks about age and experience, how her age and experience has also helped open doors for her. There's not an overwhelming sense of discouragement from her when you talk to Joanne about her many years in ministry as a woman. There's actually a sense of clear-eyed recognition of what's at stake, what the obstacles are. Yes. But also a fundamental, I don't even want to say hope. Like I think it's for her, it's real, right? It's genuinely real that women, we're going in the right direction and women do have a place in the church and that place is growing and growing and growing. And so I think we just need to keep, I think if there's anything, that's the legacy she opens up for you and I, that I want to choose to lean into on days when I can feel really discouraged is that, here's this woman that's been at the front lines for so long. And for her, there is fundamentally a sense of encouragement and excitement and hope for the future. So I want to lean into that vision.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yes. One of the lessons I continue to learn from Joanne and that I am striving to learn more deeply and to ingrain within myself is that capacity to not just hang on to hope, but to live it, to indwell it. The hope and the imagination of the future that she embodies is profound. And I think is something that I know I aspire to. And I'm sure you can't be in Joanne's presence for more than a couple of minutes without, just smiling or laughing and, feeling hopeful about the future.
Yeah. And she also brings that to bear too in her, we joke every time you're with Joanne, you're going to hear stories. Going to hear stories. And she's in the halls of power. She has access to these leaders on an international and national level. And you can't spend more than 2 minutes with her without hearing a story about, I was in DC and I was meeting with so-and-so. And it's never from a place of boasting. It's from a place of look what God is doing. She can see the big picture. And so she shares that with us to say, look what the big picture is. See what God is doing, how God is moving on behalf of the church and women in the church, but the church as a whole. So it's really encouraging.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And maybe that's a great place to end this episode, to end on this note of hope. So let's end with this benediction. Those of you who are listening, maybe you're a woman preacher who is struggling in your current context or trying to envision what the future might look like or what path God has before you. Maybe you're someone toward the end of your career trying to reflect on where you've been and where God has taken you and how you might put your arms around those near you to encourage them as they continue to walk. So as we move forward, our prayer for you is that God would imbue and indwell within you that sense of hope, that contagious hope that helps you to see possibility where you might be currently seeing frustration or pain, that helps you to see a brighter future and to work toward it and to set aside whatever inhibitions and things are keeping you from moving forward in that path, but to move forward with a confidence in your calling and a confidence that nothing you've experienced is wasted. There may have been pain, there may have been frustration, there may have been hurt, and we grieve with you. We acknowledge your pain. And we pray that those experiences can be redeemed for you as you continue to move forward and to live out your calling and to live into the future that God has in store for you.
Silence all the lies about what I lack. Find my pride and innocence coming back. See the good ahead about to level up. Cause now I finally know that I'm good enough. I'll rise higher and higher, I'm catching on fire. I'll rise, I wanna fly up and see what I find is mine. Free from apology, nothing can tether me. To be amazing, I'm so done comparing, I'm just creating. All I wanna be is who I am. When they see me up here, they'll know they can. Rise higher and higher, I'm catching on fire. I'll rise, I wanna fly up and see what I find in. Nothing can tell me.
Joining us for this episode of Preach Her Stories. If you enjoy our show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to make sure that you don't miss an episode. You can also follow us on Instagram at Preach Her Stories. If you would like to support the work of this podcast and elevating women preachers' stories, consider becoming a patron of the podcast by going to patreon.com/preacherstoriespodcasts. You'll get access to exclusive content and experiences.
This podcast is created and hosted by Holland Pryor and Kristen Wright Taylor. Sound editing and our theme song, Rise, are by Andrea Hamilton. To hear more of Andrea's music, visit hopefulpop.com or search for her on Spotify.